not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nubs. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no
hey,
pictures
Ramblers,
of pigs shooting down brothers
get
on the
instant replay. Now where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
Now funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry. Did I break your concentration?
What the f*** is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's funny.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, motherfucker! Do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together? Is my shit together?
Nice personality combination. Hostile and intolerant.
So that's it, then. No one else really knows anything.
Broadcasting system is on the air.
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
We're on.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. Now, tomorrow, Jimmy on the board. SP futures up 2. NASDAQ futures down 81. Do we have Professor Lou?
Good morning.
How are you, bud?
Just peachy. How's things in Chicago?
Actually, the weather is a little better. It's still kind of, everybody's kind of reeling from the last few weeks where every night it got down to like 80 at night. I mean, this is just not, this is unusual. I'm not going to say it's global warming or anything, but it's humid and warm at night.
So one of my most unpleasant memories of Chicago, and you know, it happened multiple times, obviously, was walking from the train station at Adams Street there across from, you know, Union Station, across the loop to get to my offices over by North Wacker and or West Wacker, and the dew point being somewhere like 68 or 69 degrees, it just you start sweating almost the minute yep. you step out of the train and just start walking. And I just remember too many mornings like that.
See, you're one of those guys, you're kind of like me, that has issue with that. We're not like hot weather guys. But there's people that are hot weather guys, you know?
Well, it's the humidity. I mean it was so humid. That's one of the things here. I mean, even on a, you know, a really hot summer day here, the humidity, you know, is typically a manageable 30% or so. And you can, and in the mornings it's quite comfortable. You know, it can be in the mid 60s and or low 60s, and it's dry as a bone. And you step out and you don't feel like you've got condensation forming on your clothes. You know, you step out of an air conditioned place.
Well, some people in the suitman world, because I used to have to wear a suit way back in the day. Some people were as comfortable in a suit when it was 100 degrees as other people. You see pictures of old baseball games where guys are wearing suits and they're. Did you? There's a. I don't know who did it. Remember the book, and then it was a miniseries, Isaac Storm.
Yeah, I read it by Gary Larson.
It was about the Galveston hurricane.
Yeah, the Galveston hurricane.
Well, they did the thing on TV, and they were talking about how absurd the summer was, the humidity and the heat, and it was 104 during the day and blah, blah. All these guys are walking down the street with suits, vests, ties all the way up.
Yeah, I've never understood that. I've never understood how people in New Orleans, you know, yeah. Galveston was a relatively, well, it was a prospering town before the hurricane hit it, but, you know, Houston is one of the most uncomfortable cities in the United States if you're outside in the summertime. So is New Orleans.
I thought New Orleans was worse. I mean, there you don't even have horses. They have mules because the horses can't handle it.
Yeah, it's I've never understood it. And you know, I was a lawyer. I practiced law in the summer in some fairly hot places. And I was in a suit every time. And if you think about it, you think about the fact that they did not have all year round wool then. It was, I think, pretty much if you were in a suit in the summertime in places like South Carolina, right, where they actually shut the courthouse down for the month of August because of the heat, you would wear seersucker.
Yeah,
and I'm not even sure what seersucker is made out of.
It's a light cotton.
The light cotton, but that was about the only thing you could be comfortable in. And if you're out doing anything in those kinds of climates, you understand why the South really didn't become a major economic player in the United States until air conditioning became widespread.
One of Audrey's best friends, her father. God, how old that guy was. I mean, let's say how old he was. Well, let's say when I was 50, he had to be 90. But if you went to see him in the summertime, he had a seersucker suit on. And, you know, he practiced up here before they had air conditioning in the courthouse.
What is hilarious is going to Europe in the middle of the summer, where it's getting hotter. They've had some really hot summers there, and they don't quote believe unquote in air conditioning. Their governments have gotten people brainwashed to the idea that it's because they've got such lousy power generation, but they don't believe in it. They don't like it. It uses up too much energy. It makes you sick.
Can you imagine how to air condition those old buildings?
Well, but you know, still you can buy little portable units that you can put in there. And they don't believe in it, and so one of the things that came out of the World Cup was when the Europeans were coming over here en masse and finding that, you know, we air condition our shopping malls, we air condition, you know, yeah, our stores, we air condition pretty much every place, and they're astounded at it.
Well, we're also an average of 60 pounds heavy per person here, which, you know, makes it harder on the. There was Audrey has a well, had long way back. She had a little place down in Ogden Dunes, right? And it was a log, and she didn't really know any of the history of it. I mean, she just had it, right? And had it for a while. She sold it, and all of a sudden, one lady calls her one day and says, "I'm coming over there. Can I come see the place?" And Audrey's like, "Well, that's kind of bizarre, but sure." And she goes, "Well, I'm not going to be here." But the lady next door let her in, and she went around, looked around, and so forth. She comes back. The lady had left on the dining room table, kitchen table, whatever, about 25 pictures. Evidently, it was one of the first places down there. I don't even know if there was a road from the highway. It was just this place in the middle of like a sand dune. And there was no plumbing. They got a picture of these old dudes. There's her place. You know, it was smaller. It did put a little bit of dish in there, but it was logs. And next to it is an outhouse, and in the sand there's three guys sitting in the sand with like dress shoes on,
yeah,
three-piece suits in the hats on. And I'm going, wait a minute, you're going down to the beach in the summertime and you're going to go out, sit outside in the sand, and you got your suit on. I don't think those guys owned anything else.
Look at the old pictures of places, you know, beach places like Coney Island, yeah, in New York, where the women are walking around in these hats with what looks like scarves holding the hats on, and these heavy dresses, which, you know, are like multiple layers of yeah, fabric. And the guys are all in suits and boaters. and you're looking at them going,
but everybody's 130 pounds.
Well, the other thing I'm looking at is I'm thinking, yeah, I'm pretty sure you didn't have roll-on deodorant back then.
Oh no.
I can only imagine what the laundry bills look like.
Well, I'll ask you the major question, Mr. Attorney. If everybody stinks, does anybody stink?
Yes, they do. Mm. Trust me. Having been in Europe, yes.
My buddy my buddy McPhee, I've told the story a couple times, he worked for the Fed, right? So he was doing a conference, I don't know if he was in London, where the hell he was. Then they had something in the Middle East. Then he had to go to China. And he goes, well, he always tried to get his mileage up, right, for when he retired. He wanted 1 million miles. So anyway, so he flies like to Tel Aviv or someplace. And then from Tel Aviv, he flies across, I guess, how do you get from Tel Aviv to China, to Hong Kong? You must have to, I don't know if you go across Russia. You probably go south of there. But
Probably through India.
Well, so anyway, he goes, yeah, you know, I got on this plane. And I'm like, got the feeling I'm the only guy who took a shower before I got on the plane. I said, Jen, truthfully, how long did everybody stink? And he goes, about a half hour. And you got used to it. I'm like, okay, then.
No. Not my experience. Your friend's lucky.
Oh, he was lucky. Oh, he was older. Maybe his nose was no good. But
that's right. Not my experience. Well, let me just.
Okay. That guy is. Now here's a guy who works for the Fed, and he says to me, "You know, they didn't give me my 25,000 miles." And I go, "Jan, you didn't fly around the equator." What do you mean? if you fly north of it, it's not 25,000 miles. If you walked around the North Pole, it'd be like 30 feet. Oh, there's a guy doing Fed conferences. I mean,
yeah.
Go ahead.
One topic to announce today that we can just briefly discuss is, well, first of all, love the music intro and the cultural references in that intro. Who is that? That's not Hendrix, is it? Who is that?
I don't know. Jimmy, what
is
that?
No, it is not Hendrix. Give me a second.
Anyway,
did you get the YouTube video about this, the professional football guys, how there's been a couple of guys that have come back from basketball and already played?
Gil Scott-Heron.
Okay.
Gil Scott-Heron, wow.
And what year? Can you tell me what year the song was?
Oh, the song. I'm talking about the basketball player.
It's got a reference to Julia in it, which I thought was really interesting. Do you remember that television show?
Vaguely.
First TV show with a black female lead.
Really?
If I recall correctly. Yeah, early 70s, late 60s, early 70s.
I know one of the first black ladies on a show that was legit was Uhura in Star Trek.
She was, that was a groundbreaking there too.
Yeah.
But Julia was the first, and it was sort of a drama comedy kind of thing.
And didn't she kiss Kirk on one of the shows?
Yes. Uhura did, yeah. Yeah, in the future the starship captains will all be horn dogs chasing after their crew members.
Well.
So other important news, if you want a little titillation, you can dial up the latest Sydney Sweeney ad campaign for something called Novig Sports, which I had not heard of before, but I certainly have now. And so this is somebody capitalizing on pretty much her, well, more than 15 minutes of fame, but she's quite the ad source. It's funny to me that how quickly we got rid of whoever that guy was, Mulvaney or whatever his name was, for Bud Light, the guy who dresses up as a woman. Prancing around on the screen. How fast we've moved on from that, I think.
You gotta be quick in this world.
Well, that's right. But I don't know how long the videos from Ms. Sweeney will be up, but if you're a sports fan, they're worth a look.
What happened to, what's her name, Paige Spiranek? She used to be everywhere, and now she's, I don't see her anywhere. She get a bunch of kids or something?
You know, that's interesting. I YouTube used to throw a lot of her stuff up on my feed for some reason. I think I actually watched one of her videos one time, but yeah, I haven't seen her lately.
I like the one where the guy's golfing with his wife, that she's up on the green, and the guy's staring at the green.
the wife's
all pissed off.
That's right. But I haven't seen her. She was huge on YouTube. She must have
decided to have a family. She was the most photographed lady in the world for a while.
Yeah. And I haven't seen Olivia Dunn up lately either. Although I have seen pictures of her, but she's another one of the very stylish, beautiful.
We know who's all over the style thing now is what's her name, Caitlin Clark. She's everywhere out of her basketball uniform.
Well, good, because if the WNBA can't figure out how to promote her, she's got to figure out how to promote herself.
Well, that's the truth. Hey, there was a YouTube thing regarding now they've let LSU has capitulated. Why, just on a legal thing, why out of all this mess? In this day and age, of course, anything can happen legally, I guess. Why does the conference think they can make this kind of rule with every court case going against them? They still think they have the power.
I think they do. I think a conference can establish its own eligibility rules, I think. And absent some collusive... conduct by the... by multiple conferences, I think a conference could say we're not going to allow you to play if you bring pro players in.
Not to take the other side, but this is radio.
No, go ahead.
I think if a team decides to not hire somebody because they went somewhere else first, I could hire, if I had a smaller accounting firm, I could decide not to hire somebody who worked for a big six firm. But if, in my mind, if 15 people got together and said we're not going to do it, I think that's a problem. And I think if a conference does it or several conferences do it, I mean, at what point does it become a combination, a restraining trade? I don't see how a conference can do that. I mean, there's nothing that says what makes somebody. I mean, if you never paid anybody, I mean, what's the logic? I mean, if you never paid anybody 30 years ago, I can certainly understand not bringing somebody back from the Bears to play at Notre Dame, but if you're paying guys out the ass more than they're getting paid on the Bears, for God's sake, how do you say the guy's a pro?
They don't necessarily have to make that distinction anymore. But the law's pretty well established that conferences can set eligibility rules for their members as long as they're not outright engaged in, protected factor discrimination.
Which they are.
And a rule, what's the protected factor?
Well, I mean, somebody leaves school, tries out for another team, doesn't make it, and decides to come, he's got eligibility left. How do you tell him he can't play?
That's not a protected factor. Well, protected factors are things like race, gender, religion, that kind of thing.
Well, I guess I don't understand the logic of saying somebody, that's like saying if somebody's playing for, Crestwood, he tries out for the Cubs, doesn't make it, he can't play for Crestwood anymore. What's the logic there?
If Crestwood decides that they are going to set that as a rule, that's their rule.
They can't, but can the league get together and do it, and can several leagues get together and do it?
I think that individual leagues can do that, number one. Number two, if they don't collude, if there's no evidence of collusion between the leagues, multiple leagues could say we're not going to allow this kid to play because he's turned pro or he's signed a pro contract. And that rule, I think that would probably be enforceable. There's at least one state court decision, and I think it's in Louisiana, that allows that kind of a discretion on the part of a membership organization.
Well, if the SEC does it on TV, and the next day the Big Ten does it on TV, I guess, what do you mean by evidence of collusion? They didn't play golf together, but at some point, I mean,
there are legitimate bases for an organization to make that kind of like a college sports league to make that kind of a distinction. And as long as they don't have, there's no evidence of it, you know, and because there's economic justification for it, as long as you don't have emails, phone calls back and forth between the conferences saying we're gonna work to exclude all these guys, you likely have a legitimate business decision that
in this day and
age would hold up.
I guess my question is why does anybody get the right to do that? I mean, if you got eligibility, these guys they're losing the war here. I think, Lou, there's going to be a, someday anybody who's in college can play ball. I mean, that's to me where it's heading.
And well, the SEC has rules to use an analogy that you just gave me. The SEC has rules that says you have to be in school before you can play. That's collusive.
Okay, that part I understand. But so if a guy graduates or doesn't, and signs up for the next quarter or signs up for the business school, says I'm undrafted, I'm going to give the Bears a chance. I got a one in a hundred chance of making it. And guess what? I don't. I come back. I go back to my first business class. Why can't I show up for practice?
Well, and again, the school has the right, or the conferences have the right, to make that kind of a distinction, because they control their own product. And if you force them, if you try to come in and force them to accept somebody who has violated the rules of their eligibility, a court is likely to say there's a legitimate basis for this. I don't see any indication of collusion. The conference could do it. This is their membership thing. This is their membership requirement. It's no different than requiring somebody to be in school at one of the conference schools.
If you take this to its extreme, I know you always quote the law, and you're always right. But what if all the steel companies joined a steel conference? I mean, nobody would put up with that crap.
It's a little bit different.
What's the difference?
Because for one thing, they're a collusive effort like that is problematic. Sports conferences are organized differently than, for example, combinations of other businesses under production or steel production or other kinds of businesses. Sports organizations require collusive conduct to a certain level, and the courts have acknowledged this.
So it's weakening, but I mean, I don't know, it may be.
But
I don't have any problem with LSU or the Alabama saying we're not going to do this. But when you get to the point where, because I don't want to do it, you can't do it. That's where you and I kind of diverge here.
Right, but again, this is the conference saying this.
I think it's
the functional equivalent. For example,
I think we both agree that in 5 years there's going to be four conferences that either talk through the media or talk on the phone every day. At some point, you look at it and you go, "Wait a minute, they're looking to reduce competition, not raise it."
Well, yeah, I think that's probably right. But we've talked about this before, that sports is unusual and maybe unique, in that you have to, each team in a sports league has an interest in maintaining the economic viability of every other team in the league.
By their definition.
Pardon me?
By their definition.
No, this is economics. The league itself relies on the existence of other competitors, right? So that it's in the interest of one team or any individual team in the league to maintain the economic viability of the other teams, because if the other teams go away or the league becomes non-competitive, you lose the entertainment value and the league folds.
Well, but again, who gets to? I love jousting with you because we both bring out some decent ideas. If for instance, the Yankees have more money than Kansas City, which they do, the idea always is the Yankees could buy all the best players. All right, so that's always the reason for this.
And
right?
For a while they did.
And for a while
just
they
like
did.
The Dodgers, just yeah, like the Dodgers yeah. are doing.
But on the other hand, if you didn't have this kind of collusion all the way through the system. All the people that maybe are in the Yankee organization at the double-A level that can't break through and are essentially being held back by the Yankees could race over to Kansas City and play for Kansas City, but they can't. So it's not just on the top end where it sounds very prestigious and intelligent that, well, we got to maintain competition. They restrict it all the way down through the rest of the system.
Yeah, right? Because of the way they draft players, right?
But I'm saying that the Yankees, the Reds right now, have this phenom playing shortstop, right? They don't need to be restricting 10 other shortstops in their organization if there's a shortstop job open in Kansas City. But they do.
They're allowed to do this because, you know, the fact that you've got a phenom now doesn't mean you're going to have a phenom 15 minutes from now.
But if you and I, if our son was playing shortstop, the last place we'd want him is in the Cincinnati organization.
Well, right.
We're hoping for a guy to get hurt or run over by a bus.
But this was the same issue that John Elway and Eli Manning faced with the NFL. When they were drafted, they looked like they were going to be going to some horrible team somewhere. And they essentially told the clubs, because they had alternatives, look, we're not doing this. And the clubs, the NFL clubs, caved. But absent that, absent some very unusual economic alternatives, which both those guys had, you're gonna be stuck in here because, again, the leagues have determined this is the best way to make long-term competitiveness factor.
Here's where we always split. We want to talk about other stuff, but here's where we always split is when you say the leagues have determined. And whenever I hear that, my hair goes up on the back of my neck. Who the hell are they? I don't get to determine what people do in my industry.
When you come in and when the courts come in and say, okay, what's going on here, the courts are going to defer to the leagues because the leagues are effectively the owners. And before the court goes in to start messing with owners' rights and owners' ability to make their own investments, the courts look at what's the basis for this. In most courts, you don't see this as much now because we've got a rogue element in the federal judiciary. But most courts would say to the parties in litigation, I'm not the expert here. You guys are the expert on what makes your business work and what makes your business run. So in most cases, I'm going to defer, and if it's a question of what's best for the league, in most cases, I'm going to defer to you and your judgment.
I'm not anxious for what's best for the league. I'm anxious what's best for everybody.
Well, and that's great. In that case, then get your money together and go set your own league up.
You know, when you say the courts, you do realize that this whole thing is dancing on the head of a fat person dancing on the head of a pin, saying Major League Baseball is not interstate commerce. That's what started this whole mess.
I thought what started this whole mess was the congressional
no. It's a court exemption decision. It's not a congressional exemption. It's a court decision.
I'm sorry. The
Major League.
You're right. Yeah. It's the Kennesaw Mountain Landis.
It was your what was it? Wasn't Oliver Wendell Holmes? It was Learned Hand. It was one of the big titans of the world that said that they only cross state lines just because it's not really interstate commerce.
Yeah, and that exemption is acknowledged by decades of congressional.
It's acknowledged by decades of ignoring it.
But. You know, none of the other sports leagues have that, by the way.
Right. But they act like they do.
Well, but they act like they do because, and we go back to the original reason you brought me on the program, they go back to that because, or they act like that because they have something called a labor exemption under the, what is it, Taft-Hartley? It's either Taft-Hartley or the NLRA. But they have a multi-employer bargaining unit that allows them to collude within this unionized structure, and that makes perfect sense if you think about it. Because if you're going to have a sports league, again, with multiple entities that have to worry about the competitiveness of everybody else, and a union comes into it to negotiate with them. The union can negotiate because the union represents the workers, the players. The union can negotiate collusive contracts across multiple employers because that is the best for the employees, and the court acknowledges that. Says, you know, I'm not going to come in and say what's best for the workers because I don't know. But they've got a union that they voted for that supposedly does have their best interest at heart, and I'm going to allow that union to operate.
Well, you're going to, you know, you and I are, I won't say opposed, but I look at it, if the slaves formed a union and said, you can only have beatings on Saturday and Sunday, I guess that's a contract, Lou, but it's not a fair one.
Well, the slaves are getting paid multiple millions of dollars.
Okay, but
so
but,
it's hard for me
well,
to consider
how
that.
How much are the owners making?
I don't know, but the slaves are doing really well for
I mean,
what's effectively unskilled labor.
I'm not going to argue that, but the idea is just because you and I think some guy getting his head beat in every week for $100,000 a game is worth it. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. You know.
Well, nobody's forcing them. Again, nobody's forcing them to be out there.
I understand that. Nobody forced people to work on
pro sports are acts between consenting adults.
Has there ever been a limit to how much males are willing to take risks to work for a few extra bucks?
Okay, so there's all some really interesting social stuff that gets into this. Going on with somebody, a guy I follow on Substack and a couple of other places, he writes a column called Ethics Alarm, and he's convinced that football is the most unethical sport in America because of the injuries, and specifically the CTE, but just because of the injuries.
Hey, speaking of which, you're more.
And I argue with him all the time about the fact that these are consenting adults out here. Okay, there's nothing unethical about, and you know, frankly, it's fun. It's like skydiving. You know, people get killed in skydiving all the time. It's like stock car racing. It's like, you know, downhill skiing at high speed. It's risky. You have a group of young males, over-hormoned people with poor impulse control. That would, by the way, that's you and me at age. Who are, you know, looking.
If I back out a little better, I'd play softball Sunday. So right. That hasn't changed.
looking to establish our bona fides as men, and this is the perfect way to do so: is to put pads on, go run down a field at full speed, and throw yourself into somebody. Yeah?
The problem I have, and this is what I made a mistake by reading his book. By the way, he just died, Jim Bouton. And he said the problem with baseball is that the owners want the players and the fans to view it as a sport while they view it as a business. And if somebody else views it that way, they're pissed off.
I knew several NFL owners back in the day, and they were businessmen, and the people that own these clubs are business people, but I think at some level there's an understanding that the incredible attractiveness of the sport involves exactly what I just said.
Without a doubt.
And so, you know, I don't think it's an unethical sport. Again, if people are any more than I think, stock car racing or skydiving or, you know, any other incredibly risky extreme sports are unethical. If you want to do this, if you want to get out and or boxing, I don't think boxing is unethical. If you want, you know, that's two guys beating each other up, or mixed martial arts. Those are guys beating each other to a pulp without any protective gear.
To me, I wouldn't use the term unethical, but I don't want the cost to be an externality. I don't want Medicare or you and me paying for George Conner's 22 surgeries after playing for the Irish and the Bears instead of the Irish and the Bears. I have to assume that Dick Butkus's knee surgery, and I gather artificial knees at some point, more than the Bears or Illinois. I have a problem with that. I mean, I know most people don't, but I do. That's an externality. That was a cost that the Bears should bear, and they don't.
Why shouldn't Butkus bear it? If he's not on Medicare yet.
Well, he's dead now, so.
Yeah. I mean, he's not on Medicare.
No.
But I mean, why shouldn't the player bear it?
Because it's an externality. It's a cost.
The player made the choice to play.
Okay. But people saying people they don't have if you're a lot of times the ownership or the company has more knowledge about the actual risk of the job than the person the 25-year-old male does.
40 years ago, I would have absolutely agreed with you, but it's getting closer.
It's getting closer. I'm with you. I'm saying
and Tom, I mean, come on. Every time I stepped onto a football field in high school or college, I knew that I was that this could be the day that it all ends. Every time, I didn't think about it all the time, but I knew that I was taking a physical risk every time I stepped onto the field.
I feel the same way when I well not so much in softball, but certainly every time, as uncoordinated as me, every time I slid, I felt that way. but I tried to do that as little as possible. I'm with you, high school, college, but now when you've got a mega business. You know, where you've got, you know, a guy like Herb Adderley cashing in his pension because of knee surgery he needed to live it on the street. I think that's a problem. You know, I just do.
I understand. But I also point to the incredible for the guys that play it at that high level, the incredible attractiveness of the game to them as individuals.
Oh, sure,
not
sure.
Not just forever. To the extent that they deliberately hid their injuries from their, you know, their employers, because they did not want to be, or taken off the field. I always think of Brian Urlacher's, and apparently this was widespread. Brian Urlacher's comment that he would deliberately fudge and screw up the answers on his cognitive tests at the start of the season, so that if he got a concussion during the regular season, it would be less likely to be detected because his baseline scores were lower than normal. I mean, that's an appreciation of the risk, an understanding of the risk, and a deliberate attempt to frustrate the ability of the organization to try to mitigate it, all for the joy of playing football. The pleasure of playing football.
I get it. Hey, are you going to go out and become a precinct captain so you get your $5,000?
You know, isn't that weird? I don't know what that was when he said that last night, and I don't know whether it was an off the cuff remark. I saw it pop up on Twitter, and I went, what? What is this?
These things are starting to compound, Lou. These crazy comments that are. A little nuts. Hey, what? Why am I getting the feeling? Please tell me I'm wrong. Why am I getting the feeling that any other country in the world now that is a no good nick, meaning like North Korea or China or somebody, is testing out their new stuff in Iran, shooting at us? And boy, that does not sound good to me.
I think it's likely we're testing our stuff.
Yeah, but we certainly. I care more about our guys.
I do too, but I mean, it's in the sense that. In the sense that China had supplied, it's been a tough couple of years for Chinese defense companies, because they supplied most of the air defense stuff that Iran was using, and the Israelis first just cut through it, like a hot knife through butter. They just went right through there, and now we are, and so this is a slap in the face to China and to Russia with their defense stuff, and. We've demonstrated that the Israelis have demonstrated that our defense technology is superior.
Yeah, but didn't we have to bail the Israelis out on their big dome? Didn't we have to bail them out because theirs didn't work either?
We're not bailing them out. The Iron Dome has always been a collaborative effort between Raytheon and the Israeli defense contractors. It's always been that way. The new system they've got, which is called David's Sling, I believe, which is their high altitude ballistic missile interception system, also a collaborative effort. I mean, it works with when they have enough interceptors. They don't shoot at everything and try to knock everything down, but it seems to be working. I mean, our Patriot systems, you know, we've refined that. We learn a ton from the targeting of our establishments and what we can shoot at and how we shoot at it. We've learned a lot about that. Our Navy systems have been tested. We've predicted that. Our early warning systems have been refined as a result of this. I mean, you know, if you want a historical analog, it's the Spanish Civil War. You remember that? What happened there?
I mean, there were huge advancements during the Civil War.
Well, the Spanish Civil War.
I mean, our Civil War.
No, never mind our Civil War.
But I'm saying there's always advancements.
The Spanish Civil War was a test ground for the Germans.
Yeah.
And to a lesser extent, some of the Western European powers, but especially the Germans. They tested a lot of their stuff there. I think you could make a pretty good case that what's playing out in Ukraine and what's playing out in Iran right now is a dry run test of a lot of different weapon systems and a lot of different techniques in fighting. But yes, we're watching this come out in real time.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not something that's, I don't.
I will say this, Tom, and this may be an unintended consequence and maybe a positive one. I think China has looked very carefully at what's happening in Ukraine and looked at what Taiwan is doing and has done recently and is recalculating on a daily basis how difficult it would be to take that island and what the cost would be if they decide to try to do it.
You mean invasion?
Yes. Just in terms of trying to put forces ashore and how, you know, the Taiwan's defense strategy has often been described as the porcupine strategy.
We were at one point thinking of invading Japan. How the hell would we have done that?
Well, we had the understanding of what it was going to take, but we had the forces and the material marshaled to be able to do that. But now with precision strike stuff, and especially, you know, the ubiquity of drones and autonomously piloted vehicles, to try to put, you know, landing craft and ships out on a flat, you know, coverless area like an ocean,
yeah,
to move them across there with a, you know, an island that's basically got a, you know, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 separate smart weapons targeted at you, this thing suddenly gets to be a lot more difficult. And I think China has watched very carefully what's happened in Ukraine.
I never dreamed. Well, I'm not into it as much as you have. I just assumed that they were talking about some kind of an economic/naval blockade with a couple of missiles here and there until they gave. I never dreamed that they plan on dropping a million people there.
Oh yeah, I mean they practiced it. They've been practicing it for years.
I always thought it was kind of a threat. How do you pull that off? They don't have a navy.
Well,
you
pull it off with mass.
How many landing craft do you need, for God's sake?
Well, they've got them. That's what they've been building. That's why they've been building ships. They have a much bigger navy than we do right now, and it's modern. Their weapon systems are all modernized, and they've got, you know, over a million missiles and artillery rockets right across the strait that they can just fire continuously at the island.
Well, that's what I thought they were going, something like that. Not you know, 400,000 guys in landing craft. Of course, they don't really care.
No, their doctrine. Now, do they want? Will they look for economic measures first? Yes, but I think, you know, I said I think 3 years ago that the window for an invasion of Taiwan to forcibly repatriate the island, which they were talking about, you know, 5 or 10 years, they've been talking about forever. Their ability to forcibly repatriate Taiwan, take it back, I said 3 years ago that the window for that would start to close after 2027, because our vulnerability right now and Taiwan's vulnerability is probably at its peak. We are moving stuff in there, but we're not fast enough. We're distracted in other places. We've depleted assets doing other things, and you know, by the end of 2027, however, you're going to start seeing, you know, a flood of new weapons, autonomous systems, hypersonics, all this stuff starting to come online for us, and this massive buildup that we've had to undertake and start to take effect.
Where are we going to put it? We got less naval vessels than we did 2 years ago.
We're going to have to build the ships. We've started contracting for shipbuilding with in our own shipyard and in Korea, for example, and with Italy. And we're
what
getting
kind of ships
faster.
Are we making?
Pardon me?
What kind of ships are we making?
We're making destroyers, light cruisers, and if we can get, and submarines, and if we can get our design, naval ship design operation going, we might have a battleship or two. Within a decade?
I'm not Joe Navy or anything, but it sure seems to me that I would feel a hell of a lot more safe. Well, you know, I guess I'm safe. Why don't we have like 50 World War II size escort carriers that are totally drone capable, and I'd be much happier with those things than I would with two more John F. Kennedys.
Agreed. And that's one of the reasons why the focus now is going on these smaller ships like destroyers and light cruisers that can serve effectively as what are called missile trucks or gun trucks, where they can fire, you know, 200, 300 long-range missiles or act as drone carriers. By the way,
don't you need some kind of a deck to land a drone?
No, these are expendables. These would be attack drones.
Well,
they're capable of launching autonomous, you know, surface or undersea vehicles.
Well, you know, I guess I'm saying is some of the stuff, it appears like the drones would almost be the size of a World War One aircraft or something. You'd like to be able to bring that back.
Well, the new autonomous aircraft that are going to fly alongside our fighters are basically the size of F-16s.
You need to land those.
You do, and we have to come up with runways to land those. But and the Navy's got, you know, those things can operate off aircraft carriers.
For those that don't know what an escort carrier was, they were essentially a small aircraft carrier that didn't really have much of a defense, but it was built on essentially the hull of like a Liberty ship, where you could actually use it as an aircraft carrier, but you didn't want to get in a fight with one. But it was fine for a convoy type of thing and anti-submarine warfare, correct?
But both we and the Chinese are more developed at this, are also deploying shipping container type weapon systems, type launchers that can be stacked onto any kind of a transport, and you just put them on there, and the shipping container is autonomous. It contains the drones or missiles, the guidance package, everything. And you just drop it on there, activate it, and now you've got a moving launch system. The Air Force is doing the same thing with its cargo aircraft.
Well,
it's dropped.
I think that the as the drones get more better. How's that for a word?
More better.
I think you want to be able to get them back too.
Right. A number of them are recoverable.
Yeah.
But for the attack systems. What you want to be able to do, and this, remember we talked about this concept of distributed lethality a couple of years ago. The idea is you want to spread the capability of launching an offensive or defensive weapon. You want to spread that capability across as many targets as possible as many vessels or aircraft as possible. So you provide a targeting problem for the Chinese or whoever we're going to get in a fight with, It involves a lot of missile cells. They're called cells, the individual launchers. It involves putting them in you know, minesweepers and transports and logistics vessels. It involves strapping them onto cargo aircraft where they can be dropped out of the back of a cargo aircraft. The Air Force has already demonstrated this. They
instead of dropping bombs, you're dropping drones.
Yeah, yeah. So like you have a pallet it actually looks like it's just a big box riding on a pallet in a cargo aircraft. And they open the cargo door in mid-flight, you know, 30,000 feet. They open the cargo door, and this thing, this big giant box, slides out of the back of the aircraft. As it falls out, a parachute comes out, stabilizes it, the fall of this container, and then it activates, and out of the bottom come 12 or 15 cruise missiles. And they fall out. As they fall out of the bottom of this thing, their wings pop out, and their guidance systems turn on. And they've been pre-programmed to go to a certain direction and look for targets. So, and they're you know, 500,000 nautical mile range systems.
What do you?
And they're stealthy.
How do you yoke together here? We have some time. How do you yoke together all this stuff? By the way, I consider everybody else is doing it. I'm not arguing that we need it or not. Every one of these places that's involved in this stuff is flat ass broke, including us. I mean, Russia, unless they're stealing it from somebody, they don't have any dough. China, the whole place is under mortgage, for God's sake. Japan, they're not involved anywhere, but they owe twice as much per person as we do. We we weren't in this bad a shape after World War II, for God's sake, money-wise. Why is everybody going down this rat hole when nobody's got anything to, they don't have a pot to piss in, basically, money-wise? I don't get it. I mean,
So a lot of this is driven by what you see, what we've been, I mean, we watch. This is very similar to what happened with the Soviet Union back in the 70s. We flatlined our strategic delivery systems in the early 70s and said, okay, we're not going to build any more nukes, and we're not going to roll up. We got 20,000 of them. We're not going to use any more. And we tacitly said to the Soviets, we're going to let you catch up. And you know what happened? They caught up to us, and then they surpassed us because they were not interested in a stable sort of balance of terror militarily. They wanted to win. We've seen the same thing with China. The understanding was, the Chinese needed to get their defense establishment up. Okay, we got it. But what we have seen is a monstrous buildup way past anything that they need for self-defense. It's an aggressive, offensive-oriented military, and it's pushing. It's challenging the coastal and territorial waters of its neighbors. They go into the Philippines regularly. They challenge Australian vessels in the open sea. They challenge Indonesia. They challenge Japan.
Kidnap the leaders of a place so you can put your buddies in charge of their oil business?
I'm sorry?
Did they go grab the leaders of another country so you can put your buddies in charge of their oil business?
They're doing something similar. Slightly less aggressive, but I promise you, if we pushed into Taiwan in a major way, they would view that as a threat. But they have stepped up a monstrous military buildup, way in excess of anything they need for self defense, and are aggressively pushing out.
The people that control this stuff, and I'm not going to shoot against.
So well, military. Yes, why?
I know,
yes,
I get it. I understand. They like obviously
this
are doing.
Is why.
Well, why did Japan decide they had to go kill everybody? Somehow the wrong people get in charge, right? I mean, China, if they could, what they need is 10 of the companies from Taiwan to open up places on mainland China. For God's sake, they could become the next Taiwan if they wanted to instead of worrying
doesn't,
about taking...
Doesn't work.
I know.
Well, doesn't work.
What doesn't work?
We tried that. That was the whole theory. That was the whole theory behind allowing investment in China in the 1990s.
I'm not talking about the way they do it. I said if you just look at it as an economist, you go, you guys could be Taiwan, for God's sake.
That's not the
get it. That's my whole point, right? Is the people that get in charge... I mean, who the hell got in charge of Japan? The goofballs that did all the stuff in China and the other places. Japan didn't need to do that. They were growing tremendously without that.
The Chinese leadership...
I know it's the leader. I'm saying the same thing, trying to anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Chinese leadership believes steadfastly that they are the victims of a colonial empire push and a colonial fight back from the 19th century, and that this, it's now their turn to step up onto the world stage and take over and dictate human history for the next however many
and do all the, hundreds do of years. All the bad things the other people they thought people did to them, basically.
Yeah, basically.
Well, I mean, it's not funny. I know that, but it's bizarre.
No, I mean it's, but that's their role. That's the orientation of their leadership, at least as it's been expressed in their public writings. It is the orientation of their military, which has adopted, although you see less of it now, has adopted something called the wolf warrior ethic. And if you Google that, you'll see a bunch of their writings come up where they talk about the fact that it is China's turn to step up to the world stage. The West is failing. The Chinese model is better. And, you know, the China, and it's, there's a racial, big racial element in this as well. The Chinese race is you know, naturally superior, and now we're showing it.
The only problem with that is they don't seem to care about their own people if they're so superior.
I mean, that I'm not going to argue with you on that. It's hilarious right now that a certain element of the young population in China are trying to put Mao back up on a platform and you know, say this is the way, this is the model. Things were much better under Mao, and I'm going, he killed like 60 million of his own people. Come on, dudes.
Yeah, but, well, you, but that's you, you it, probably have, but I if anybody has a we got a couple of minutes. Anybody wants to read a couple of chapters about the crazy stuff you ever read? Did you read the couple of chapters in George Marshall, Soldier and Statesman, about when he was over in China? You ever read that part?
I don't. I'm sure I did, but I don't recall it.
Well, everybody thought that the war ended and he was sent over to Europe for the Marshall Plan. That's not what happened. He essentially retired.
Right.
He got in his car, drove home, and literally when he was coming up the driveway, the phone was ringing. It was like Truman saying, "You got to come back. I got to send you to China to try and negotiate this deal between these two idiots, Mao and Chiang Kai-shek." And basically, I don't know if he used the term idiots, but that's what he meant. So Marshall goes over there with his wife, and he was there, I'm going to say, well, it's memory's wobbling on me here, 4, 6, 8, 12 months he was over there. And he sent Truman a letter. He goes, "These two guys, there's no chance. They're morons. They don't care how many people they kill. There's no thought of peace. There's nothing I can do here. Get me the hell out of here." And Truman said, okay, brought him home, because his wife hated it. And only then did he go over to Europe and take over for, was it Morgenthau or somebody who was screwing the whole thing up over there, and he went over there and fixed it. But in the interim, he said, "I've never met two people like this, Mao and Chiang Kai-shek. They don't care how many people get hurt, how many people get hurt. They don't care. Because this is not any kind of humanity. It's not like fighting the Germans or anybody. They at least cared about people to a certain extent, because these guys are out of their mind."
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's... I'm not going to argue with that... with that assessment.
I mean, what? And Chiang Kai-shek, he's the one who fled over to, well, it was Formosa, now Taiwan, right? And
yes.
That's the whole basis of this whole
mess. The Kuomintang party, yeah.
What was over in Formosa at the time? Was that just regular people and these guys piled in and took over, or what?
Yes, basically.
Because I don't remember that part.
Yeah, I mean, it was a Chinese state, and they were part of the Chinese government.
How the hell did they get over there?
They took boats.
I mean, they had somewhat of, probably part of the Navy was still under his control.
I mean, a mass evacuation.
Oh, God. You write this history. Isn't it bizarre, though? By the way, are you guys going to fill up Lake Mead this year, or what? Are they going to...
No. Maybe? No, we're in trouble. Unless we get some kind of 200% snowpack this year, we're not... It's going to take years to recover from this.
Are they going to bag Lake Powell and just have Lake Mead?
That is a possibility. You know, they're going to have to figure out something, because the water's not there.
Well, there was somebody who originally was one of the main designers of Lake Powell, I was reading, that said back in the day, "We don't need Lake Powell. This is crazy. We just need the one. And we're going to regret this." I mean, I don't know if you're really like that.
Well... I mean, it was a good run for a while, but like I said, we may be entering into another, you know, climatic long-term drought, like what caused the evacuation of the Anasazi out in southwest Colorado and northern New Mexico.
Well, or if they had any place to go, we would have evacuated Oklahoma in places in the 30s, wouldn't we?
I think that's true.
All right, bud. Take care of yourself. Talk at you next week.
Good weekend. Take care.
S&P futures now down 13. NASDAQ futures down 195. So we're leaking here. Do we have our guys?
Yeah, well, you've got me, and I'm anxiously awaiting my $5,000 dividend from Donald Trump. You know, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I'm going to suggest that I think he's lying.
Wait a minute. If you suggest that my president is lying...
I should have asked if you were sitting down before I mentioned that.
Plus the idea, if I race down the block, who knows I'm going to vote for it. If I vote Democratic, he's still going to send me a check? He's going to send a check to people in Illinois?
What scares me is how does he know who's voting Republican unless he's got another joker up his sleeve?
Boy, you know, we have not talked, I don't want to go into it too deeply, but this kicking out of Maria Bartiromo is pretty interesting, isn't it? Her being fired?
We'll bring in Andy's a media advisor here.
Well, I mean, she sent the memo from the, allegedly, sent the memo from the Fox to the White House?
Right.
Yeah, I think it was a text.
Okay.
Good morning, first
How are
of
you,
all.
Andrew? How are you? Did you guys enjoy your Labor Day?
Yeah, in our own way, my own way. I think I was catching up on work.
There you go.
at any rate, it was a text message, and I mean, to broaden it, when I was worked as a daily newspaper reporter, it was a firing offense at my newspaper to send any part of a story you were working on to anybody that was mentioned in it. And what that did was preserve the independence of the news organization, but it put a heavier burden on the reporter to be accurate, because, of course, it'd be simpler if you sent a copy of a complicated story to an expert that was involved. So what happened with her was a version of that, where it wasn't simply a story. She was sharing the deep secrets of her employer with the White House.
She was sent to Steve Bannon. I didn't know he was still around. I guess he is, huh?
Unfortunately, he is.
I didn't write. You know, I was reading this stuff because I met her a long time ago. By the way, we had a long conversation. Get a load of this at the swimming pool when I didn't look so bad, and she was in a white bikini. I don't know if either one of us be doing that now, but anyway, pleasant lady, and I didn't realize how she was the backdrop of this. Is as popular as she was, the station always really blamed her a little bit for that huge settlement with the voting machine stuff in Michigan.
Oh, right. Yeah.
What was that?
Dominion voting. Right.
She launched on the air about how those machines were crooked, and then when they weren't, what was the settlement? Hundreds of millions of dollars, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, I think it was $625 million or something like that. You remember they used to call her the Money Honey?
Yeah,
when she was.
Well, you know, she was in the New York Stock Exchange, and I actually saw her there one day because I used to visit there once in a while, and that was before they had anything on TV. So people would run out. And she's a tough girl. I mean, she's a Jersey girl, and they would come out and they'd put. Guys would jam, somebody would run out from the desk, he'd be on the phone to the studio, and he'd run out and jam the next piece of news in her hand, right? Well, once in a while, right. Some of the people there didn't like the idea that they had some lady and, you know, was doing news in New York Stock Exchange. Guys would run up and jam something in her hand, it'd be like a request for oral sex or something. She looks down at it, and she thinks she's reading the news, and it was, the guys were not all that kind to her down there. She went through some stuff. I mean, I'm proud that she did that. You know, I don't know how she got so up Trump's behind so far as time went on, but I don't get that. I mean, people, I guess, read the power and they go that way, but she became, you know, quite the Trumper. They were not kind to her on the New York Stock Exchange floor at all. I mean, she, you know, deserves some credit, I think. I mean, not that whether she's nice or not matters to her, I'm sure, but saying that they were not all that happy to have her down there, let's put it that way. They'd run in front of her and they'd jam stuff in her hand with, like, you know, gross stuff on the sheet of paper and everything. I don't know how many people know that. But.
Yeah, she was no Irving R. Levine, was she?
No.
Going back a few years there.
Well, you know, just how crazy, Andrew, when we were on the floor trading, you know, knowing the information flow that you guys know and knowing how much they thought it was, first of all, you couldn't have a cell phone there were phones in the pit. You couldn't dial out from that phone because people didn't want people on the floor getting information, you know, thinking we were getting information from somebody else to trade ahead of it. For a while, we couldn't have CNBC on the TV in the pit because they thought that was an advantage that we were watching the news on TV back when CNBC might actually have been news. I don't know. You couldn't do that. The only thing we were able to see was the Dow Jones and the Reuters tape. Try and read that thing. Plus, if it was a big piece of news, it was stacked up behind other stuff, right? Remember, they'd, I don't know if you guys were ever on the floor, but all of a sudden, on a busy day, they'd say the tape is 8 minutes late. What good did that do you? If you were in an individual crowd, I don't know why you guys got me on this. I'll blame you for getting me on this. If you're in an individual crowd, say the three of us are trading, which I was, Owens, Revlon, and something else, you could filter the tape to where if there was any news on your companies, it jumped ahead of the other stuff on the tape. But that was about all you could do to get anything current. And yet the people trading against you, they could do whatever they wanted. I mean, talk about a different world, eh?
Mm.
I don't know if you guys knew any of that or care one way or the other. But
no, it's interesting. And you're talking about the realities. And to get back to, you know, this TV news or really any political news on a national level, it's... I think useful for the news consumers to realize that the reporters, their editors, and the news organizations are not simply reporting on politics, but they're deeply involved in the politics of their own organization that can be changing. Because in her case, her network was totally on board with, near totally on board with pro-Trump advocacy. And she just miscalculated how far those internal politics were. But which cost her the job. But it's, you know, just to put a figure on it, the signs that she would have seen through her career might have and did encourage her to take this extra risk. And I suspect other people at the network, Sean Hannity and others who's in frequent communication with the president, off camera, we're doing similar things. But it's a minefield in which some cases it blows up.
Well, when is, I don't know what the middle, you guys know more about, you know, news in the day, and I just, because you were in it, when you had, you know, the Walter Cronkites of the world, you had an hour of, quote, news. And I think that for the most part, it was news. Now, you competed, you know, CBS competed with NBC to get the biggest audience, you know, at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, whenever it was, but I don't know that there was all that. I mean, right now, I mean CNBC, you're on all day long. It's a whole different, even if we did it, it's different. You've got to hold your audience. The only news really is the thing running across the bottom of the TV where you get. I mean, I don't know if people know this, but if you go to any place you go, whether it's Schwab, PTI, I know that's how I put this in the same sentence, and you get your quotes for your options and stuff, and for a lot of stuff, you're going to be delayed for 10 minutes. All right, if you kick up Bloom or CNBC and put the I'm looking at it right now because the news come out here. My quotes there are 10-minute delay coming across here. That shows the S&P futures down 11. All right, they're down 13. I'm looking at my live feed from my IB feed. But if you watch the TV, they've been given, I'll use the term, a dispensation. They don't need to delay. They used to, but I mean years ago, but then all of a sudden they're alive. So, yes, to watch CNBC, are you getting the news? You're getting the feed that you really can't get anywhere else unless you have an account someplace or you pay for the feed. So in that regard, it's news. But the rest of the stuff, if Andrew wins five more awards and they want him on CNBC, they're going to ask you, what do you want? What do you want us to ask you? They're not going to. If they ask you the wrong thing and you say, next time I'm going on Bloomberg first, they don't want that. So in order for them to get Trump on there for an interview, they can't embarrass him. I mean, it's not going to happen. So at that point, it kind of ceases to become news. The question is, where's the trip point, Andrew? Where do you go from one to the other?
Well, it's different trip points at different times for different stories. I have to interrupt for the benefit of the imaginary person who only listens on the show to Thursday. They should go back and listen to yesterday's episode of Stocks and Jocks, which prompted me to call up Wayne yesterday, say, Wayne, you got to listen to this, because the chief and one of the guests are talking about when they hit the trip wires at different stations. instructive, amusing in retrospect, and maybe it wasn't.
They didn't want me saying Warren Buffett was a monopolist.
Yeah. Well, you didn't even say it.
No, I didn't say it.
You were asked, for those who missed it, and you should go back and listen to it. It was around 8, it was after 25 minutes or so after the, in the second hour yesterday, you should tell a story. You were just asked, why is Warren Buffett increasing his share of the railroads? It's your story.
So. Well, I mean, I was on allegedly to talk about Walmart, and then they said, oh, because this came across the tape, he goes, why is Warren Buffett either was buying a bigger share or a member of the Burlington Northern? It was Joe Kerner, and I said, well, Joe, the Burlington Northern is all the railroads in the northern part of the country. It's the Northern Pacific. It's the Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy, and it's the Great Northern. So anything that goes into Montana or North Dakota is owned by the Burlington Northern. And oh, by the way, they just got all this oil up there, and they maybe you could truck it out. There's no pipeline, so they have a monopoly in pulling all that oil out of whatever basin up there. And they said, well, okay, see ya. Okay, then. I never got invited back. So, I mean, I wasn't supposed to say that. I mean, it's kind of the truth. I mean, it was a monopoly before he bought it because it was allowed, the major railroads there were allowed to combine. But now we're down to two. We got three railroads now, right? The Burlington Northern then went on to buy the Santa Fe, correct? And the Union Pacific bought the Southern Pacific. So there's two railroads going west. And on the east side, you've got the Chessie system and you've got the Norfolk and Southern. Well, Norfolk was the Norfolk and what that was it? Norfolk and something bought the Southern Railroad and bought somebody else. And running down the middle, you've got the Canadian National, which bought the IC. And did they buy the Kansas City Southern? Somebody did. But now one of the Western railroads, the Union Pacific, wants to buy the Norfolk and Southern or something. So we're going to be down to like three railroads. I mean, why?
And they're not the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe. It makes me.
They're part of Burlington now. Yeah, they're part of the Burlington.
Yeah.
Wayne's got a great story about not only being his last appearance on Fox News, but resulting in his ban. And all he was doing was trying to be nice.
Is there a wall with the pictures of, like, you and Carl up there?
Wayne, why don't you, if you don't mind, I'll tee it up kind of quickly.
Yeah.
I'm at the National Press Club here in Washington, and Wayne says, well, I just got done taping the Bill O'Reilly show, and let's watch it, you know. So we watched it, and it's Wayne's final appearance.
Well, so yeah, they didn't let you on live. You got to be taped. There's no way they were letting you on live. Okay.
It was over annually. Fox, especially guys like O'Reilly and Hannity, would get on their high horse about nobody celebrates Christmas anymore. You can't say Merry Christmas, and all of that was a bunch of baloney, of course. It was the war on Christmas. That's how it was built. So. I'm on the O'Reilly show, and I'm taking the point of view that there is no war on Christmas. This is all, you know, this early culture war type thing that was happening. And so I'm in the D.C. Fox studio. I'm looking straight into the camera, O'Reilly. It comes to the end of the show. And O'Reilly, you know, he does this thing with the pen, and he twirls it around. He said, well, this is the no-spin zone, so, Mr. Mattson, I'm going to give you the last word. And I looked into the camera, and I said, this is right before Christmas, maybe a week before Christmas. I said, Bill, I hope you have a very Merry Christmas. There's silence on his end. And dead air on TV is like dead air on radio. I mean, you don't do that. And then his response was, Mr. Mattson, I'm not buying your act.
Come on, Wayne. Give it a real O'Reilly accent. I've heard the story enough. Give it the Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah, well, he looks into the camera and he does this thing with the pen and he says, Mr. Mattson, I'm not buying your act.
Well, he thought you were one of the people who was trying to screw Christmas.
What's that?
He thought you were one of the people who was leading the charge to no Christmas?
And yeah. Somehow, I don't know. I was writing a lot of op-eds back in those days, so I may have written an op-ed that crossed his desk, and he decided, well, I'm going to take this guy on because, you know, he don't think there's a war on Christmas. I had similar on-air jousts with Sean Hannity, they are not into news reporting. They're into, you know, this verbal jousting. It's sort of like a verbal sort of wrestling, except with a lot of back and forth. It's funny. I was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner a few years later in 2009. It was Obama's first one. And who's there but O'Reilly? And he's walking towards me. I said, hey, Bill, I don't know if you remember, but you were pretty tough on me on your show on the war on Christmas. He says, he looks at me, shakes my hand, and says, it's all showbiz.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm sure that...
There you go.
Well, you know, there's a fine line. I mean, I don't know how good I am at this, but what you do is, a lot of times, especially with you, I don't have to do it so much with. I don't know if I shouldn't be saying this. But with Andrew, I like to jostle Andrew because if I can dig down a little bit, there's even an even more intelligent comment pops out. Because some people, you just, the more you ask them, you're not jibing them, you're actually digging for, you know, there's more in there and you're trying to get it. And I don't know if those guys do that, but I do. I actually want to hear what Andrew knows and what you know and other people. And sometimes you have to dig for it a little bit, even if it sounds like I'm disagreeing, I'm really not. But then we have a couple guys, like Hal and Carl, you can't agree with no matter what you do to them. It's impossible. Every once in a while, I'm trying to agree with you. Would you just let me for a second? Some people are kind of just like that, but they have, I mean, Hal especially, because he has such a background in everything, for God's sake, that you love to get them just to go off on anything. It could be Navy, it could be economics, it could be math. I mean, you want them to go off on something because it's something you never heard before. I mean, it's really interesting to deal with the different personalities. I mean, that's why I like doing it, obviously. But so let me get this straight. If Illinois goes full blue, even and but they keep the House and the Senate, I'm getting a $5,000 check.
No, I think it's. I don't have the text in front of me of what he said because he doesn't mean it. But it's if Republicans win. So what that would mean. I mean, the rules of the game are pretty loosey-goosey. You're talking about, in the previous segment with Lou, conference rules, they at least have rules. Here, the rules are, who knows what they are, but to send $5,000 to every citizen, if the Republicans win, costs about just short of $1 trillion. So who authorized this money? Where's the... on a previous show, you said, gee, somehow the Treasury or Federal Reserve has an extra trillion that we don't
have. I didn't say that. Your man said that, Bessent.
Yeah, but where does this $1 trillion come from?
Well, he said it. Didn't he say I have $1 trillion? He said something about Biden had... $400 billion in some special kitty, and he's up to $1 trillion. I remember asking you guys last week, I go, if we're $40 trillion in a hole, where's this extra trillion hanging there? Where is that coming from?
Well, I remember that decades ago, Nelson Rockefeller, when he was governor, it was famous that he didn't take his salary. And then years later, I'm reading that the state of New York kept its banking largely in his brother David's bank. And I'm thinking, well, if Nelson Rockefeller is not taking a salary as governor, which was maybe $20,000 a year.
Yeah, but, it wasn't much.
But the state of New York is keeping its money interest-free in his brother's bank. Who cares about $20,000? That bank has a lot of money sitting there.
Well, he did die. He did die with a smile on his face.
Oh God!
You're talking about Nelson.
Yeah. Nelson.
Well, this is family radio. We won't get in there. But mentor of Wayne and me says his. A producer for CBS and NBC, John Kelly, he said, yeah, the odd thing is his left shoe is on his right foot and vice versa. It's kind of weird.
Well,
I'm sure
Trump has done this, but I'm just trying to go through the math with you guys. Does Trump even have a calendar? I mean, our debt per taxpayer is now $360,000, which is kind of a lot. So, are we going to assume that voters are taxpayers? But how many percent of the people vote? 30%. But we're going to send the $5,000 to everybody, whether you voted Democratic or not. It appears, right? So, if we send, if we, how many taxpayers do you think we have? 100 million.
Well, I still haven't gotten my $3,000 Doge check.
Yeah.
Is anyone else? And then there was the. Between the Doge check and this latest scam, wasn't there like a $1,500 dividend, tariff dividend?
I was going to say that. Well, no, Walmart and those guys decided to keep all that.
They kept it, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
There was no somebody said they were driving this stuff to somebody else, but Nike got a big check, too, and Nike's on like an all-time low in a stock. You wonder, you see all this money, we're going to go to break here in a bit, but I have a question, I have a very serious question for Andrew from something that I got on Quora, not that you can't answer, we'll save that for after the break, but when you talk about all this money that's going to this college football, all these sponsors and all that stuff, because now SoFi is giving money to Notre Dame, huge, like 20 million a year or some crap. And I think the you're a veteran, Wayne. Your outfit, the insurance company that advertises all over the place, they are now sending big money to the service academies. I don't know if you knew that or not, because they want to keep them in the fray. So all this, but I mean, is it worth it? I mean, Nike's been doing this. We kicked the graphs up for how many years now? They're pushing. Well, I know they gave. I don't know if they gave. They started giving shoe contracts kind of when I was in school, so that was like a long time ago. So they've been on this like a really long time. Now it's gone way beyond the shoe contract to where Under Armour was paying the Notre Dame quarterback $1 million 5 years ago. I mean, is anybody, if the three of us, and we'll bring Jim with, we're sitting on the board of Nike, is somebody going to say, by the way, is this stuff worth it?
I mean, I haven't been professionally involved except running organizations that had relied on sponsorships. And partly because of that, I read what seemed like a very in-depth article that explained this phenomenon that I'll share briefly here. It's not that a company, let's say a shoe manufacturer or beer, expects the endorsement of some marginally famous person to persuade people to buy their product, but they hope it brings back pleasant memories that operate on an almost subconscious level that associates the brand with the pleasant memory, and that over time that is where they get their value, not the specific endorsement resulting in a purchase.
So you're talking about PR and almost subliminal PR.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's to associate the brand with good and pleasant thoughts.
I'll give you, when I was I learned some of this when I was chairman of the marketing committee at CBOE, because I didn't know anything about marketing. And I learned from the people there. It wasn't like I brought stuff to the table, but what you're talking about, and we actually had a discussion last night with our producer, and there is a huge difference between, sometimes it's a fine line, but between PR and marketing. In marketing, when Pepsi spends a lot of money on the Super Bowl, it's something that the next day you're liable to buy. And probably are going to, you know, most people are going to buy, well, not, you know, a lot of people are going to buy a soft drink of some kind the next day. So Pepsi can actually chart the bulge, if they did it right, the bulge in their sales over the next 5 days, 6 days, then it starts to kind of decline a little bit. And they can say, okay, we spent, you know, $10 million on Super Bowl ads, which you can by the time you film the ad and everything. Maybe you can do more than that. But it gained us $25 million in extra sales over the next 2 weeks. They can sort of chart that. But if Andrew, I don't know why I picked Andrew for that. I mean, if Wayne has a casket company and he advertises caskets, you're not going to kill yourself just to go buy Wayne's casket. But if somebody in your family dies a year from now, that's what you're talking about, Andrew, that, God, where do I go for a casket? Well, gee, I like this guy Wayne. He's got Wayne's casket company. Casket. So, I mean, that's more PR. It's embedding something in you that when the time comes, you're going to use it. The greatest example of that, 100%, well, not 100%, but in my opinion, was, remember the old Alka-Seltzer commercials? They won commercial of the year or advertisement of the year, like, what, 3 years in a row? With what shape your stomach's in, and then with the little stomach telling the guy not to eat the pizza and stuff. And what was the other one? Oh, there was another one they did.
You mean, I can't believe I ate the whole thing?
Yeah, and the stomach's looking at it. Yeah, she'll eat the whole thing. And then it was a drop, flop. Well, the problem is,
Plop, plop, fizz, yeah, fizz. Yeah. That was the cartoon.
Yeah.
The cartoon Alka-Seltzer.
But it was, if you had indigestion, you might grab an Alka-Seltzer, but you're not going to go grab one tomorrow just because it was a good commercial if you feel good, right? I mean, why would you? So, Andrew, you don't know how right you are. What you just said, that, by the way. Anyway, SP futures down. We're leaking here, down 24. NASDAQ futures down 265, and maybe when we come back, you guys can tell me how Bessin comes out and he's going to buy $6 billion of long-term bonds, and the bonds go flying down the minute he did. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
How would you like to save money on nearly all your prescription drugs? We've set up a special toll-free number for the RX Outreach Program. They're a nonprofit company whose mission it is to make prescription drugs more affordable to the masses. They don't take insurance, and in many cases, your prescriptions are even cheaper than your co-pays. They carry thousands of different prescription drugs, so whatever you're taking, there's a good chance they have it. No coupons are required, and this is not a discount card. It is pure savings on your prescription drugs. They specialize in generic meds for any chronic health needs you have. Call with your prescription and find out for free how little you can pay for your prescription drugs. Remember, we don't take insurance, so call right now.
800-586-9885. 800-586-9885. 800-586-9885. That's 800-586-9885.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Listen, are you a 50-year-old person looking for term life insurance? Then you need to talk to Bob. Bob specializes in helping people find $1 million or more of term life insurance for a couple of $100 a month. Look, you need to know there's a price war in the term life insurance business, and you may be paying too much. Call Bob, and he'll shop and see how much money he can save you. Look, this could be the last term life insurance policy you ever have. Your rates are guaranteed for the next 20 years. That's right, guaranteed level rates for the next 20 years. And if you're a smoker or your health is not perfect, Bob has great rates for you too. So for $1 million of term life insurance coverage for a couple of $100 a month, call Bob right now. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. 800-989-1415. That's 800-989-1415. Paid for by Term Direct.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
We're back.
Hello, and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Jim Lawler on the board. We got some issues here now. S&P futures down 37. NASDAQ futures down 327. PPI out today. CPI tomorrow. This month it's reversed. PPI is first. Number came out 0.4%, which is not exactly what everybody wanted. But for the this is the part. You got to look below the numbers here, and I'll talk this over with our guys here in a second. Up 0.4%, which is as expected, with goods advance 1.1%. Ouch. Services rise 0.1%. That is horrible. And we're talking year over year here is 4.7 from July 2025. It's nowhere near this 2% that these guys are talking about. I mean, it's nowhere near. And oh, by the way, I might as well say it first, the interest rates now, we're up almost a full point since Bessent lobbed his missive out there. The 10-year, remember when the spot was 4.5, we were going to get nervous. Then it was 4.8. Well, now it's 4.89. So we're getting close to 5% in the 10-year. That is not good news for the market, for mortgages, for anything. Anyway, S&P futures down 34, NASDAQ futures down 318. I'm going to kind of skip the rest of this stuff because we get in a delay in Europe. Oil, however, that I won't skip, up 351, 99.56. Brent up 344, 104.65. Whenever guys comment on that, that is not good news. FX, Japan is still big move up today, and they're down because it's up to 154.56 between their interest rates and Bessent's intervention, and we drove it from 163 to 153. God, I wish we'd have had that news. Wouldn't it be nice if Wayne could give us stuff like that? But a 10% move in a currency is a dramatic move. If you gave me that number, I could have made you some dough, guys. How about a quick traffic weather sports other than Cubs lose?
Cubs did lose, but on the inbound Kennedy, we have 31 minutes. The inbound Eisenhower, or inbound Eaton's, excuse me, is 49. The Eisenhower is 50. And the Dan Ryan is 22. Quickly in weather in Phoenix, it's hot. It's 89 degrees with a high of, they think the high will be, again, it says a high of 109. So another hot one in Phoenix. In Chicago, it is 69 with a high of 77 today. And, of course, the NFL started, and unfortunately, the Patriots lost due to 3 interceptions in the fourth quarter. Back to you, Chief.
Guys, we have all kind of places to start here. Let's talk about these numbers for a second. Oil through $100 a barrel. Inflation kind of to the moon here. 1.1% on goods, that's like really, really awful. And some of it obviously has to be energy going back up that last month, but what are you guys making of this? I mean, I don't. It's getting worse. It's not getting better.
I would add to the mix here what we're seeing in political situation in Europe. Germany had a state level election this past week.
Oh, what is that? What does that mean?
Well, they've. In Germany, they're called Länder, but we would call them states. It'd be provinces elsewhere. So there was this election in Saxony-Anhalt. That's in the former East Germany. And for the first time since the end of World War II, a political party that has an affinity for the Nazis won the election. Not only won it, but won it in a landslide. The question now is, will they form the... Would they have enough seats to form the government? They're three seats short of being able to form their own government in that state. But this party is opposed to Germany helping Ukraine. They're very pro-Putin, which is kind of weird. A neo-Nazi party that likes a former KGB colonel. And that's also weird because a lot of the people there who voted for this alternative for Deutschland party, they have a lot of nostalgia for East Germany, especially the older people. So here they've got both an affinity for Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin. That beggars belief on that alone. But with that success there, and it looks like the far right party in France could win the presidential election there next year. And the Reform UK party, which is, got a lot of crazy people in it, but they did quite well in the last local elections in the UK. Are we seeing a situation in Europe developing like we saw prior to World War II in the 30s? And a lot of this, I think, has to do with the economic situation over there and with the... fuel being so expensive, and Trump being sort of a real disruptor on the international stage. I just wondered how that kind of instability is playing into fears in the marketplace.
Well, I'll lob into this for a little bit because I want to get Andrew's opinion, but I've been, out in the left field for. I've been on with John and this show for 20 years, and I, for that length of time, I've constantly talked about the middle class, regular people are falling behind every year, just like Chinese water torture, a drop on your head every 6 months, to where everybody feels strained. Where, and we have the situation with young people, they don't see the world like we did when we were young. And we saw really nothing but opportunity, no matter what it was. You may not have got there, but you could become a trader with 10 grand in your account. You could become a reporter just by going down there. I mean, you weren't paid very much, but you were on the fast track. One of these days, you're going to win a Pulitzer Prize. Everybody felt that tomorrow was not everybody, but I'm not talking about Mayberry here. But the feeling was, if you kick your ass in gear, you could do something. at least in the cities like Chicago. I don't know if we were like that in the rural area or not, but this has been gradually stripped away. And when people come into politics, just like the Bohemian corporal, it's not your fault, it's the Jews' fault. They did it to you. People are willing to find a scapegoat, whoever it is, and you have to resist that. But it takes an economic problem. I mean, nothing could be worse than Germany during the Depression, for God's sake. I mean, look at the fertile field that Hitler had to work on. It's these communists' fault. It's these Jewish people's fault. I'll take care of that for you. I'll stop the stuff in the street. And by the way, he did. And for 8 or 9 years, from stealing money from other people, he probably was the best in terms of economic growth leader in anywhere in the world, including Roosevelt. Yet, and if he would have croaked the night before he invaded Poland and never did it, he might have gone down as one of the greatest leaders in the 20th century, because he stopped the people's view of how it was sliding downhill, and oh, by the way, who was causing it. I mean, people didn't even really know that the dentist down the block was the cause of their problems, the Jewish dentist they sent their kids to. But somehow or another, they believe this crap. And there's people here that think everything is wrong with them is because of 100,000 immigrants here that shouldn't be here. I mean, how could anybody get people to believe that? I'm not saying that the immigration policy, especially for the people on the higher level where they bring them over at a certain price and they shove somebody out of work here, that's not what anybody's even talking. I mean, we believe it here. I mean, there's people here that believe it. And now over there, anything you talk about, I mean, look at here, guys. The people that can't stand Trump, the people running a socialist, Andrew, do they even know what a socialist is?
Well, to pick up on that last point first, a lot of these victories by the so-called ultra-left or socialists are really just anger. They're not commitment to, in any kind of informed way, to necessarily an ultra-left or socialist platform. It's the voters for these candidates just want somebody to do something, which goes to your larger point of whether it's right or left. But I was going to add that going back to your original point about the bonds, sometimes when you announce a big unexpected cure for a problem, like buying $6 billion of bonds, you accentuate that there's a problem.
Well, we just blew through, just while you're talking, we just blew through 4.9 in the 10-year. That means mortgages are going up. That means the government's now paying more for their $40 trillion debt. I mean, it's not good.
Yeah, and to get to one of your middle points, or at least Wayne's middle point about the German elections, behind the scenes in that election was the world's richest man, Elon Musk. And while he was forbidden from as far as we know, directly banking and funding this neo-Nazi party that did so well, he really extended his financial empire to help them in other ways, non-monetary ways, to achieve the success they did. And he's basically a chaos agent who is playing a very long, and I would think, sinister game, not only in these German elections, but elections here in the United States.
Does he want apartheid for everybody?
Well, that's where he's from, South Africa.
Yeah.
And Wayne has done research on his family leaving Canada in the 1930s to go.
And Peter Thiel's family moved from Germany to apartheid South Africa. So
yeah,
we have another one.
So these are some of the richest and most powerful people, and they like this chaos, and in the short run it benefits them, but the rest of us have to think, where is this leading? What's their real mission? And they're not exactly family guys. I mean, Peter Thiel is a homosexual. Elon Musk has all these children, and apparently, I mean, I'll just leave it at that. But
they're test tube babies.
Yeah, test tube babies. And think this is so strange.
Andrew, if you
and chilling. Why are these people affecting our lives so much?
Because we let them get too big, we let them play the system, and they got too much money. Now, my question is: let's say somebody normal gets elected. Now, whether you like Trump or don't, you got to say he's not exactly normal. If somebody normal gets elected, the lay of the land here. How much of a Don Corleone would the three of us have to act like to bring these people back to where their influence isn't where it is? I mean, paying taxes might help a little bit because I don't seem to do much of that. How do you get this mega group of people? How do you disband a plutocracy, which is essentially what we have? How do you even go about doing that?
Well, it's a tough assignment, but it.
Well, let me ask you: has it ever been done before?
Well, I watch a lot of deconstructions and analysis of the Godfather trilogy. For example, how did Michael Corleone realize it was Tessio who went up against him? We have to study these things to figure out what's going on now.
Well, he was talking to him at the funeral, Tessio.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, remember what his father
told him.
You've
done your homework.
Yeah.
Gentlemen, remember what his father told him. The person that comes to you with the deal is the traitor.
Yeah, and it was
there
Tessio.
We go, Jimmy. We're all united in our scholarship of the Godfather.
Andrew, before we got time, but I want to leave us to the last second. I read this thing from Quora Digest. You know, people write in, and some people are idiots, some people aren't. In my opinion, this guy he was talking about the Constitution, and he said that word for word it as best I can. Here's a question for Andrew, and the only little pushback between Andrew and me is he's convinced that always, you know, the good will prevail, and I'm not so sure this time. But anyway, I sure as hell hope he's right. Let's put it that way. And the question was, the Constitution is one of the most beautiful pieces of paper ever assembled by people. He said, but it is amazingly flawed. And the flaw is, it assumes that the people involved are going to be, respect the Constitution, are going to be, have some sort of a moral fiber.
Are of goodwill,
of goodwill. Yeah, exactly. Because if not, the Supreme Court can come down with all these decisions. There's nothing in the Constitution that gives the Supreme Court the phone number of like a general or a police force, where if the executive group ignores it, that they can do anything about it. There's no enforcement. If you don't pay attention to the Constitution, you might as well use it as the, you know, they used to use the Sears Roebuck when you go to the outhouse. I mean,
a paper tiger, as Mao would say. Yeah.
I hope we're not there, but I couldn't really dispute with them. And we've seen, I mean, just look at the tariff situation. I mean, by the way, tariffs come out of Congress. It says right there in the Constitution, you idiot. But wait a minute. Steve Bannon, go look at some law from 1912 that's never been used that says I can do it, and I'll use that law. I mean, obviously, the principles are not landing on anybody here. It doesn't appear. Congress has essentially left the building. I mean, where do you put this? You're our learned maven on this stuff.
Well, you've raised a number of interesting points, and at the risk of entertainment here, I'll agree with you and your expert on some of these main points. So first of all, he's correct that the Constitution doesn't clearly provide an enforcement power, And in fact, it wasn't until the early 1800s that the Chief Justice, John Marshall, whose home is just three blocks from me on Pennsylvania Avenue here, he, in a series of creative decisions, helped make the Supreme Court an arbiter that was not specifically authorized or envisioned in the Constitution, but became part of our system until somewhat recently, that they decide what the law is. Now, there's an incident where Lincoln, during the Civil War, did not so much challenge the Supreme Court, but he did challenge a ruling by the Chief Justice Taney, who was a Confederate sympathizer. And now we're seeing lots more of that from President Trump. And so the lack of enforcement power is a huge flaw. But there are other huge flaws in the Constitution, and that's why before it could be ratified, they had to have a Bill of Rights. And also a very important part of this history that's usually ignored, but it's obvious if you think about it, is that the Civil War was fought for important causes. I won't try to specify them here, but the important point is that the 13th and 14th Amendment, creating due process, equal protection, they were to remedy flaws in the original Constitution. And so the total veneration of the founders, the ones with the long hair in the 1780s,
well, they did pretty good. They did pretty good.
Did pretty good, but it was flawed at the time. That's why they needed the Bill of Rights. And it was very much flawed, which why you had the 13th and 14th Amendment, which are as much a part of the Constitution as what was written and affirmed in 1787.
Tell that to Clarence Thomas.
Well, except that I've got 13 books, I counted them once, about or by him. Only one was actually by him, and it's the least valuable. But he's a unelected politician who wears a robe. He hires very bright law clerks who do very well financially and prestigious, but
back up on it. Who pays them?
Well, at major law firms, where, by the way, the starting salary at some of them, you mentioned this, you were talking with one of the guests about a week ago about summer interns at law firms and the changes in the legal business. Well, one of the law firms you mentioned, which is a big Chicago-based firm, they're paying their summer associates what the first-year associates make, which is $250,000 a year. And they...
Is it too late for me to go to law school?
Except that it can be very political. So here's, to go to your question that you just asked, who pays for this? A signing bonus at one of these law firms, when I last checked, it would be like what used to be for a star shortstop, 40 years ago. Maybe $500,000 on top of the base salary.
Wow.
And guess who makes a fortune by advising these top law firms about which former Supreme Court law clerks are liked by the justices, notably the majority justices.
I'm going to take a stab and say it's his wife.
Yeah, it's John the Chief Justice's wife.
Oh, I thought it was Thomas's wife.
The headhunter. Did you know that?
I thought it was Thomas's wife that was a headhunter.
No, no, she's got another racket, which is she's, during the Bush v. Gore thing in 2000, she was head of presidential transition at the Heritage Foundation. And of course, if her husband hadn't cast the deciding vote and the 5-4 decision to stop the vote counting in Florida, there would be no presidential transition by the Heritage Foundation in 2000.
Oh, God.
So
it's Roberts' wife. Okay, learn something again.
So it's Roberts' wife, and she makes millions of dollars, I think a year, as recommending which Supreme Court law clerks these big firms, and I started my career, legal career, at one of these law firms, and with the dollars involved, and to go to your question, who pays for it, ultimately we all do, but in the short run, to pay a law clerk who clerked for the Supreme Court, is well-liked by the majority, is easily worth $500,000 signing bonus, plus whatever headhunter fee goes to the Chief Justice's wife.
For the blue-collar plebeians like me, a Chief Justice, does he get a budget to hire 2 or 3 law clerks, and with that budget, he pays those guys $40,000?
It's typically
grand?
3 law clerks. I was a law clerk for a federal judge at one point. And it's a great experience. And my judge, very civic-minded. In fact, he uncovered the Whitey Bulger scandal in Boston.
Really?
That was made into the movie The Departed. And that's a story maybe for another time, but it's a wonderful profession, but just like we were talking about journalists and anchors, there's heavy politics involved, and it's chicken feed to pay these well-connected former Supreme Court law clerks riches beyond compare.
Right, but the basics are each one of these guys gets $300,000 a year budget to hire three guys, and then but then they can have a couple of guys that
The law clerks don't make that much while they're working for the
justice.
That's
what I meant. But I mean, so
it's later future income.
So, but also you could have a guy who interns for nothing, and then all of a sudden gets his recommendation and ends up with a $500,000 bonus somewhere else.
Well, maybe, but to know how the court works, right. here's a mini scandal. We're out of time, but I'll just float it because it gets no recognition elsewhere. But it turns out that the New York Times just reported about a week ago that after Justice Scalia died without a will, people couldn't figure out what to do with his papers. And so Chief Justice Roberts worked out an arrangement with all the other justices that all of their private papers, working papers, will be secret for decades after everybody involved dies. And so this means total lack of accountability of what goes into these decisions, which increasingly don't even quote law, that affect our life, and people should not put up with that.
For next time, why is there a 7-year embargo on census stuff? But that's another story. But I mean, the president, you couldn't be the president tomorrow and say, I'm keeping all my papers. I mean, somebody made a determination that they can't.
No, Chief Justice Roberts gets the other justices, including the Democrats. And so the pressure on our newly elected representatives, including especially this midterm, has got to be, there's got to be accountability. And that means on the Democratic justices, you were elevated to the Supreme Court. That doesn't mean you get to wheel and deal in private and nobody knows about it for 50 years.
All right, but my question, because we do have to dash, who told the executive branch, you got to keep this stuff? And the same, how isn't the same person who it is letting the Supreme Court say we don't have to do it? I guess is my question.
Well, no, this is Chief Justice Roberts, and what's needed is, let's say, Senate hearings, maybe run by somebody like Senator Whitehouse or Senator Blumenthal, both of whom have been Supreme Court clerks and federal prosecutors, to just say, what is this stuff? And we're going to cut your budget at the Supreme Court, or maybe expand it, until we get people there that realize that it's not just a group of politicians in robes that do whatever you want and keep it secret for 50 years.
Well, it took us a few minutes just to ferret this out. This is not any kind of scandal that Wayne's going to put on the front page.
Well,
even though it's a real scandal, how big a scandal do you have to have now? It's not going to move over to $5,000 a person if we vote Republican.
Well, look, even some sex scandals these days are run-of-the-mill, and
I know this bothers both of you guys, but, you know, it's impossible to invent a new fetish. They've all been invented before.
Yeah, nothing shocks me anymore.
No. Anyway, guys, good stuff as usual. Matter of fact, better stuff than usual. I thought it was great. You guys are terrific. Jim, nice job keeping everybody in line here. SP Futures, this is not good, down 36. NASDAQ Futures down 355. Again, the catalyst is kind of a really bad PPI number. Don't look at the 0.4%. Look at the 1.1% on the goods. That's not good. It's got we're through 4.9, guys. You predicted it. We're through 4.9 in the 10-year. Not good. 4.91. 30-year, 4.35. If you thought you had a mortgage at a lower rate, you better go get it quick. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.